Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a big week in the news, the stock market plunged.
U.S. markets took a dive Tuesday, wiping out $600 billion in value and eliminating all of this year's market gains and more.
John McCain throws his hat in on Letterman.
The last time we were on this program, I'm sure you remember everything very clearly,
yes,
that we say, but you asked me if I would come back on the show,
right,
if I was going to announce.
Yes.
I am announcing that I will be a candidate for President of the United States.
Oh, wow.
And the commanding general at Walter Reed Army Medical Center is fired as the Pentagon shamefully lets down wounded American soldiers.
There needed to be some level of accountability, not only for the roaches and the mice that existed in the notorious Building 18, but for the bureaucratic backlog that really caused tremendous stress for our wounded veterans and their families.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? At home, abroad, in the markets? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by a great panel this week. With us from Washington, Mark Silva, White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He was on the plane and on the ground this week with Vice President Dick Cheney in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and all the rest. Mark Silva, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Hi. And with us from Washington, Garance Frankie Ruda, senior editor at the American Prospect magazine with her eye on the markets, John McCain and more. Garance, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Top of the week, Jack. Good to have you. Or bottom of the week as it is, I guess now.
Hello, Tom, Mark, and Garance.
Mark, you were on the plane with the vice president in the air, on the ground, we're at the bomb blast site. Wow, what was that like? And what about the brouhaha over Dick Cheney as the unidentified senior White House official briefing you guys when I'm standing there talking in the first person?
Well, that's right. We had spent the night at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan unexpectedly. It was supposed to be a one-day trip in and out of Pakistan and Afghanistan and back to Oman that night. But the weather got bad in Kabul, and we ended up spending the night unexpectedly at the base. We had lovely accommodations in plywood huts with mud river walkways between them. Yeah. And in the morning, as we were preparing to leave for Kabul, we hear sirens. The vice president hears what he called, quote, a loud boom, and things started getting kind of crazy at the base, and the Secret Service started rushing us to the plane. They rushed Cheney to a bomb shelter. He wasn't there very long, apparently. And the truth is, the attack at the main gate was very, very far from where the vice president was. Any suggestion that he was under threat is fairly ludicrous.
Mm.
There was 50 obstacles between that bomb and the vice president. Nevertheless, the pace picked up, and we got out of there pretty quickly. And to the second part of your question, later in the day, as we were leaving Kabul in the military transport that had taken us into both countries, we had an interview with a senior administration official who insisted on being named that way and then proceeded to use every pronoun in the book, so clearly identifying himself as the vice president of the United States that the transcript was almost comical.
You were on the plane through all that. At the end of this week, though, take the policy picture here for us, Mark Silva. How do you see what's going on? Word that we will, in fact, talk with Iran and Syria soon. The arrest by Pakistan, not long after Dick Cheney left Pakistan, of the man who's supposed to be the former defense minister of the Taliban. What's turning policy-wise here?
Well, I think you're seeing a couple of things happen, perhaps some breakthroughs in diplomatic fronts, both with North Korea and Iran. Unexpectedly, in the case of Iran, the Bush administration has been very hard line in its refusal to speak directly with Tehran. On the other hand, the gains both in North Korea and Iran would be fairly significant if they led to any progress. I think on the other front, you're seeing pressure. The fact that Cheney was in Pakistan is not coincidental with the fact that a high-level Taliban operative was arrested. And similarly, in this country, an Australian citizen is being finally charged with crimes after being held for years, and that's a direct result of Cheney's meetings with Prime Minister John Howard. So you're
in the Pacific before he got to the war zone.
That's right.
Mm. Let's listen for just a minute to Lee Hamilton, co-chair of the Iraq Study Group, saying this week in an interview that the Bush administration, as he sees it, is finally moving toward talks with Iran, which the Iraq Study Group had recommended.
I think there was an internal debate within the administration over a period of months about whether or not to talk with these countries. Finally, those who favored the talks prevailed.
And, of course, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who only in January was saying, we don't talk with people like this, now testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee, she said that Iran and Syria should take advantage of an opportunity to bring stability to the Middle East.
The violence occurring within the country has a decided impact on Iraq's neighbors. And Iraq's neighbors, as well as the international community, have a clear role to play in supporting the Iraqi government's efforts to promote peace and national reconciliation within the country.
Garrett's Frankie Ruta, do you see a kind of changing of the temperature of who's driving things in Washington? Now that's North Korea they're talking with and Iran and Syria coming up. What's going on here?
I think I'm extremely cautiously optimistic about what's happening, that there seems to be a real realization on the part of the administration that they're going to have to engage with the rest of the world, and that the strategy of refusing to talk to nations and instead to engage in saber-rattling simply hasn't achieved any of the goals that they had wished that it would.
So does it mean Dick Cheney is, you know, out in Bagram Air Force Base all the time now? Is he pushed back from the power line here, or is this just a feint toward that? How do you read it, Garrett?
Well, I don't think the vice president is going to be on the front lines doing any kind of negotiation. And I think the situation with Iran in particular, I mean, these are very cautious talks as part of a conference where Iran will be part of them. But it's not the kind of thing that I think a lot of Democrats have been hoping for in terms of a direct engagement with Iran on questions of its nuclear program.
And John McCain giving his unofficial pre-announcement this week that he'll run for president. I want to get you on that, Garrett, but let's listen to just a minute. Wednesday night, John McCain on David Letterman's show saying this is not the only time he'll make his announcement.
By the way, I'll be making a formal announcement in April.
So this was not the formal announcement?
This is the announcement. You know, you drag this out as long as you can.
I see.
You know what I mean? You don't just have one rendition. You know?
So you're saying this was not the formal announcement?
This is the announcement preceding
the
formal.
How do you think that makes me feel?
Remember, you were first. You know, so, you know.
He's doing the formal announcement on Leno.
All yucks all the time. It's the new way of American politics, but this was a very popular guy on his Straight Talk Express. How are you seeing this candidacy now, Garrett's Frankie Ruta? John McCain.
Well, I think the situation with McCain is really fascinating. This is the first truly open GOP primary since 1988. John McCain would be the anointed frontrunner, except the conservative base really dislikes him. We're seeing Giuliani sort of coming up very quickly. He's gone up 18 points in the polls. Time magazine just came out with a survey today on that. And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch what's happening. I was at the Conservative Political Action Committee conference yesterday talking to people who are base activists. And believe it or not, they like Giuliani, and his social liberalism in New York is not bothering them. He's managing to explain it away rather effectively for them. And McCain didn't even show up to talk to them. And there's a lot of talk that, you know, McCain is more eager to talk to David Letterman than he is to talk to the conservative base.
Mm. We'll look at what's brewing in the Republican camp on the presidential campaign side. But Jack Beatty, I want to come back to you on this issue of Walter Reed Medical Center outrage last week at the conditions there, at the paperwork put in front of seriously wounded vets trying to get treatment. And this week, a general booted. What do you make of this, Jack? Is this fixed? Is this a cleansing? Is this a papering over? How do you read it?
Well, as NPR reported this morning, it's not a fix. The man who's now in charge of Walter Reed last week was one who was heavily poo-pooing the Washington Post story. So now he's in charge there. That doesn't look like house cleaning. You know, this is the kind of story that and people can go back and look at it on the web, that anybody who thinks that we're following through for our veterans needs to look at, because of course it's not an isolated story. NPR ran a two-part series by Danny Zwerdling on treatment of psychiatric cases at Fort Collins, Colorado. There have been other such stories. And, you know, this all gets back to who is supporting the troops. And by the way, we're going to find out, I think, as weeks go by, how many members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee had visited that hospital. What about Mrs. Rumsfeld? She was a frequent visitor. Nothing from her about it.
Jack, I'm sure it's not all roach infested. There must be some other visiting rooms there.
Oh, yes, but I think these people have actually seen this place. And there was a comment by Mrs. Rumsfeld saying that, you know, that she was disgusted by what she had seen, but it didn't seem to have any great effect. So I think we're going to be hearing a lot about this in coming days.
Jack, we've got a minute before the break. Take us to North Korea and this intelligence on uranium, which was so key to the Bush policy of pushing North Korea away, and now a little backing off on what they're really suggesting there?
Yes. In 2002, the Bush administration said that the North Koreans were enriching uranium, and therefore they were calling off the Clinton agreement with them about their plutonium enrichment, and that essentially put a stop on that. And it turns out now that the intelligence on which that claim was based was dubious, perhaps not all wrong, but some wrong, and enough wrong that a senior administration official told this to the Times: "The question now is whether we would be in a position of having to get the North Koreans to give up a sizable arsenal if this had been handled differently. That is, if the administration hadn't scuppered the deal with the North Koreans in 2002 on the basis of what looks now to be factitious evidence."
Jack? Is that like truthy?
That's like truthy. Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, what happened in the interim was the North Koreans surged ahead with the plutonium bomb. So it's not a scandal on the level of Iraq, but boy, it's another example of the lack of competence in security policy in this administration.
Okay, we're off, and there's a lot more to look at. Mark Silva of the Chicago Tribune is with us. Garrett's Frankie Ruta from the American Prospect, and Jack Beatty's here. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Where do you see the world turning? With the Bush administration now talking with North Korea and Iran and Syria coming up, is a new era of pragmatism upon us? With Walter Reed dumping its general, well, who's really supporting the troops there? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Funding for On Point comes in part from the Music Emporium. For 39 years, celebrating the enduring artistry of the acoustic guitar. Many collectible, boutique, and vintage instruments at themusicemporium.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, from dirty Walter Reed to the stock market plunge, McCain in the game, and more. You can join us. Have you lost your nerve in the stock market? Has China, or does the party go on? Are you celebrating McCain in the presidential pool? Are you surprised at the apparent Bush administration exaggeration of North Korea's uranium program? A whole lot going on out there. 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALK. Mark Silva is with us from the Chicago Tribune, White House correspondent there. Just back off the big trip with Dick Cheney, where the bomb went off at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. Garrett's Frankie Root is with us, senior editor for the American Prospect. Jack Beatty as well. Of course, the stock market, especially China's, just got everybody by the collar midweek. A 9% loss in a single day there. A lot of bounce back since then. Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, testifying this week before the House Budget Committee, he said he expects some economic growth in the coming months.
We believe that if the housing sector begins to stabilize, and if some of the inventory corrections that are still going on in manufacturing begin to be completed, that there's a reasonable possibility that we'll see some strengthening of the economy sometime during the middle of the year.
Ben Bernanke saying, let's all hold on to our hats here. And the markets seem to be doing that, but who knows where we go. Garrett's Frankie Ruta, what do you read in the market's gyrations this week with the seismic booms out of China?
I think it's very worrying, and I think it's particularly worrying in light of the other things that are happening in the economy domestically, with the very high default rate in the subprime lending market, with the greater than expected declines in the construction rate, and with new home sales down 17%, which is the largest drop in 17 years in January. I mean, in 13 years in January, and you know, people were hoping that the housing market had bottomed out and was coming back up, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Alan Greenspan said twice last week that we might be heading into a recession. Probably not, but we might by the end of the year.
I'm sure Ben Bernanke was ready for him to pipe down, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he's still able to really
Yeah, and the manufacturing sector is officially in a recession, according to the Times last week. So, yeah, a bad indicator there.
And yet, there's been a lot of growth in recent years. Mark Silva, when you came out of the bubble with the vice president to this market news in Washington at week's end, what did it feel like in the White House zone? Were they, you know, all ears toward the markets?
Well, sure, but, you know, they've been so relentlessly pressing this storyline of theirs that the economy is great. I don't know how many periods in a row of growth that they've cited and jobs created since a certain point in time. They've been so relentlessly pressing this story of a good economy that, you know, they're almost stuck in that same storyline, regardless of what happens. And they're facing a contrary public opinion, which is a very sour mood in the country about the direction in which things are going economically. And the war is spilling over into that as well. The way people feel about the war is affecting their overall attitude about things at home. And it's just a very negative public attitude that probably responds to this news more than to the administration storyline.
But the market's hanging in there for now. Listeners, there's a lot on the table. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to McCormick, South Carolina, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good to be on NPR.
Good to have you, John. What do you see?
Well, at Walter Reed Hospital, I think the problem is that the Army two or three years ago, or the government said, that they were going to replace Walter Reed with a brand new hospital out at Fort Belvoir. Now, if I were the CG at Walter Reed, knowing that in two or three years the place is going to be abandoned and everything go to Fort Belvoir, 18
yes.
miles south down on Highway 1, I wouldn't spend a lot of money on maintenance of the buildings at Walter Reed either, other than that hospital where most of the business, most of the medical care is taken care of.
Are you military, John? Were you?
Yeah, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel. I used Walter Reed many times.
So when General George Waitman is booted, does it look like the finger's being pointed in the right place? How do you read this overall?
Well, that's what happens. They gotta blame somebody, so they blame the CG. That's all right. He doesn't care. He's going someplace else. He'll be all right. But the point is, that if they wanted to build a new hospital out there at Fort Belvoir, they should have kept their mouth shut, built the hospital, and then when it was finished, okay, we're going to move over to Fort Belvoir. I don't think there'd be any problem. I doubt seriously if the Army does plan to build a new hospital at Fort Belvoir.
Well, if they don't really plan to, then it's kind of a shell game here that leaves the vets out on the limb.
Not only that, but it overburdens Bethesda. So, the key to the situation is, are you real? Are you going to build a hospital at Belvoir?
Are you really going to take care of the troops when they come home wounded and the numbers they're coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan? John, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Nashville, Tennessee. Bud, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to why the press is not all over Congress. They've been underfunding the VA continually for the last 7 or 8 years, and they're turning around and blaming the poor Army and for not fixing the problem, and the Army can only do with what funds they get from Congress.
Well, now, that's an interesting question. Mark Silva, what do you say to that? A lot of, the Pentagon's fired somebody here, but still, a very jaundiced eye looking at the Army. Is it Congress that should be under the microscope here?
Well, it's not only Congress, but also the White House, which in recent years has presented budgets which are ostensibly very strong in national security and holding the line in discretionary spending, everything outside of the so-called entitlements. There's been a flatline approach to the budget as it applies to everything that's not totally mandatory, like Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, to some extent, it's also this administration. And you talk about Walter Reed and Donald Rumsfeld and the people who had visited Walter Reed. It's sort of like we go to war with the hospital we've got. I mean, that's sort of the attitude. And it's interesting that the new defense secretary, Bob Gates, so readily jumped on the Washington Post revelation of what's wrong with that hospital and has so quickly accepted responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's a different tone.
A different tone. Garance, yes?
Yes. I'm concerned that the firing of George Waitman is not going to make much difference because he's been replaced by Lieutenant General Kevin Kiley, who was actually the previous commander of the Walter Reed Medical Center when many of the problems were developing and when they were first reported and ignored. So basically, they've taken out Waitman, who has only been there since August, and replaced him with a man who was there until 2004, who has recently told the Washington Post, and I quote, "This is not a horrific, catastrophic failure at Walter Reed," and he has previously said that the problems there weren't serious and there weren't a lot of them. So I don't think that the new person coming in is going to be taking the problems as serious they need to be taken.
I got to say, just the thought of vets coming home to the richest country in the world from a war of choice to have anything less than top service when so many are coming back wounded just makes my skin feel on fire. But there are other issues of funding here. I want to look at the broader one, funding of the war effort itself. Let's hear just a clip from Senator John Cornyn of Texas, Republican, of course, saying this week that if the Democrats are so opposed to the Iraq war, they should not approve any money for it.
If my colleagues on the other side of the aisle feel so strongly, as some of them clearly do, about the conflict in Iraq, then they have an obligation, I believe, to cut off funding.
Cut the funding if you mean it, he says. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, speaking on the Senate floor this week, explaining why he still supports funding a war he is against.
Though we may disagree with the policy, we can't put the burden of what we consider bad policy on the backs of our soldiers. We cannot shortchange them in any way in battle, even if we disagree with the battle plan of the Commander-in-Chief. And so I voted, not for a billion, not for $100 billion, but hundreds of billions of dollars for this war that I think is the wrong war.
Jack, what do you make of the Democrats' dance on war funding?
Well, the fact is they cannot stop it. They cannot prevent the war from going forward. They cannot prevent the funding from going forward. What they can do is to palliate their constituencies with statements and symbolic resolutions against the war. I think there may be some promise in the Biden idea, others have joined it, of revisiting the war resolution of 2002 to take account of where we are, a civil war. But even that, I don't think, is going to materially change things in Iraq. That will only change and can only change with a new president. So the Democrats are I think Cornyn is really throwing the gauntlet down to them. They do not want to be seen as cutting off troops, cutting off funding to troops in the field, however popular that may be. And by the way, in a recent poll, by 1 point, but still, the public says cut off all funding vis-a-vis continue funding. So that is quite a statement from Americans about how disgusted they are with the war.
Here's a little tape from Washington this week. Marine Sergeant Liam Madden, active duty Iraq veteran who opposes the war, demanding that lawmakers cut off funding for the war at a rally in Washington.
We will not tolerate the rhetoric that we must support the troops by funding a war that puts them in harm's way. If you are funding a war that puts them in harm's way, you are not supporting them. You are endangering their lives for war that cannot be justified, has not been justified, and will not work.
Marine Sergeant Liam Madden. Mark Silva, help us understand where we are then in the sort of arc of this war. All the debate about the surge, now it's underway. Heavy bombardment, we're told, of car bomb factories this week. Funding not cut off, though lots of opposition. I mean, where do we come to the next intersection here? Where are we in this thing?
Well, I think we're at an intersection of politics and reality. And the reality side of the picture is, what happens if 6 months from now the Bush policy actually yields some results? What if there actually is a realization of security in Baghdad? That would really put an end to a lot of the debate. On the other hand, we don't know. We're not there yet. So where we are today is in a political quagmire where the Democrats appear to have essentially squandered their mandate. They came out of a midterm election with a pretty much agreement among the public that something had to be done about this war. And in very short order, they've turned the debate into mashed potatoes. They couldn't even get a resolution out of the Senate. They came up with a mealy resolution in the House. And this question of cutting funding, they're scared. They're afraid of offending. They're afraid of portraying the Democratic Party as a party that is not strong on national security, and therefore they've got to keep funding something that they don't support. And they're really they're lost in their own politics.
So the churn goes on right there. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York, and Sharon. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to make a comment about the intelligence in Korea and how I don't believe a thing that comes out of this administration, but I also agree with what everybody's saying about the war. But it's, the Democrats should just stand up and be strong. They're going to be seen as mealy-mouthed and not being able to do anything. They should cut off funding to the war. We're not going to get out of there drastically. We're going to do something.
But the soldiers are out there, the fight's going on, the equipment's wearing out. If you cut off funding,
Well, we have to get out of there sometime. Let's start getting out. We're not going to pull out all of a sudden. We're going to fund it so that we can pull out and have it be safe. But, I mean, just continuing this is just folly, and it's a travesty.
Sharon, we've got it. Garence, is this really all put off until, I don't know when, the fall when we see if it worked, till 08 when there's a new president?
I think realistically, America will be in Iraq until it has a different president, and I don't think the Democrats are going to be able to get America out. Congress is a very blunt instrument, and ideally, a change in funding follows a change in policy, and I think that's the approach that the Democrats would like to follow. And unfortunately, they're unable to get a change in policy first, and so they're going to continue funding it. Some people in the Congressional Progressive Caucus are calling for a fully funded withdrawal within 6 months. The big question is whether or not we're actually doing any good in Iraq at this point, or whether or not we're just sort of alternating and taking sides between two different groups in a civil war. And rather than stabilizing the situation, we're just alternating and increasing or decreasing the strength of these different warring parties.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Brad in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker should be one of the biggest news items this week.
Give us the headline.
Well, it's all about our Mideast policy, what happened in Iraq, how we took the Sunnis out. The Shias filled the void. Then, lo and behold, we don't like the Shias in charge and their ties to Iran. Vis-a-vis, now we're trying to get Iran on the the hot seat. And in all of our convoluted policies, we don't have a solid one. You know, Bernard Lewis's book on the Mideast called Quagmire says it all in the title.
Yeah, well, it feels like quagmire. But whether you agree with his analysis or not, Mark, you've been sitting with administration officials, flying all over that region all week. Have you got any new insight on the really big picture and where we're headed there?
Well, the really small picture on the front of Kabul is fairly depressing. It's a lawless place. It's a lawless region where if you can in fact have a bomb explosion at the front gate of an airbase. You wonder about the vulnerability of American forces in some ways. But you also look at what's going on throughout other parts of Afghanistan, and we've really taken our eye off Afghanistan. Iraq has so much consumed the debate that we've not noticed what's occurred in Afghanistan, which is a very much a degradation of whatever level of security was achieved after the removal of the Taliban. It's a dire situation. The Karzai government could be in as much jeopardy as the Musharraf government in Pakistan by virtue of the terrorism that's unchecked there. So it's not good. If you talk about titles, I think Tom Ricks had it with Fiasco. I mean, his book, there was no plan for what to do after the invasion, and that lack of plan is playing out today.
Jack Beatty, you've been watching the recent oil-sharing agreement in Iraq, finally hammered out there so that the different regions of the country and sects tied to them each get a piece of the pie. What do you see in that?
Well, that part is good, or at least that's something that people have been saying will help to unify the country, especially it'll help to convince the Sunnis that they have a stake in the country. They're not going to be shortchanged, their region won't be, on oil revenue. The other side of this, though, is unlovely indeed, and that is that in coming months, oil companies, mostly the United States, but some from Great Britain, are going to be signing production sharing agreements with the different regions and with the central government. Now, these production sharing agreements are used by only about 12% of oil fields in the world. They're usually only used in places where the oil company has to start from scratch, where they have to search for the oil. And what they do is they give the oil companies 25 to 30 years of large profits, 75% profits, basically, of all the oil they take out of there, and they give the balance to the government. This, of course, is highly subject to bribe. The New York Times puts it on their front page that of course, they expect bribery. In other words, the oil companies will be bribing various ministries for these contracts. And in Iraq, one oil expert said if the Iraqi people knew about this, that they were giving away their birthright for 30 years, they would be furious, but they don't know, and the parliament will approve this agreement, and we will have these production sharing agreements, and it'll be a case of our oil companies flourishing.
And the pipelines will drink. We're at 1-800-423-8255, looking at a week in the news, a big week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a supplement for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress, available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles. 617-859-
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, from Dirty Walter Reed to the stock plunge, McCain in the game, and more. Mark Silva of the Chicago Tribune is with us. Garrett's Frankie Ruta from the American Prospect. Jack Beatty's here. You can join as well. What did you hear in the Bagram bombing with Cheney inside? Last words for Arthur Schlesinger. And how about President Bush in New Orleans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Richard Daley, elected this week to his sixth term as mayor of Chicago, saying that his Chicago is on the move among the world's cities.
I want to make a positive contribution, and that's what I've done. This city is on the move more than any other American city or any city in the world. This city is going places globally, and I want to take it there.
And the voice of Fidel Castro, who's been so ill, across the airwaves this week when the Cuban leader spoke with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez on Chavez's weekday radio program. Castro said he cannot promise he'll visit Venezuela soon, but his health's improving. And then tough weather through the upper Midwest and down into the South after the tornado hit Enterprise, Alabama yesterday. Volunteer fireman Greg Oliver said the situation at the shelters he was at was chaotic.
It just looked like pandemonium, children everywhere crying and hurting and panicking. And I was panicking too, trying to find my son. And I just immediately, one of his teachers told me he was all right. I came over here to see what I could do to help.
What he could do to help, and there was a lot to be done. Let's take a call from Hyannis, Massachusetts. Cliff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to take issue with the comment of one of the members of your panel who said that the Democrats had squandered their mandate on the war and turned the issue into mashed potatoes. The House passed a 2 or 3 sentence resolution that was more or less an expression of the conventional wisdom of the last election. If the Senate hasn't done it, it's not because the Democrats haven't had enough power behind themselves. I mean, they only have 51 votes.
Mm. So you say that it's all they can do, and hats off. Is it good enough for you, Cliff?
No, it's certainly not good enough. But I think the House resolution was an absolutely clear expression of what people think, and if we haven't gotten to the point where we're going to take money away from the troops in the field, that's understandable. But it's hardly mashed potatoes. It's what the voters voted for.
Yeah, there's a voice of the voter. Cliff, thanks for calling. Garrett, let me turn to you on another issue. Where the climate may be changing, this new poll out saying that a majority of Americans now say the federal government should guarantee health insurance to every American. New York Times CBS poll. Do we have a sea change underway here, Garrett?
Well, it's sort of back to the future on this. I mean, we had the same kind of opinion polls in 1993, and that didn't really work out. So I think, you know, there's always a lot of consensus amongst the American public for this, but it's a very difficult thing to achieve legislatively. And it's certainly not something that's going to be achieved under this president. And right now, the Democrats have reinstituted pay-as-you-go rules as well in Congress, which means that for the next couple of years at least, we're not going to be seeing any major changes on the healthcare front. And in fact, there's going to be a big fight over just increasing the funding for the child health program nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Mark Silva, and with the country in a little bit of a fluxy attitude here, the president's poll number is still tough, but how do you see George Bush looking out at his vice president, at his secretary of state, his relationship with the American people? He's down in New Orleans this week. Where's he turning? Where's he leaning his shoulder now?
Well, he is attempting to rejuvenate a domestic agenda. To the extent that he can reach any agreement on immigration, that might be his best hope. There was some movement on that toward the end of last year, and perhaps he could get an immigration reform bill through. But I don't see anything else domestically occurring on his watch, really. I think he is so paralyzed by the war and the division of the public over the war that anything on the domestic front is really beyond his reach. And, you know, that health care issue, I would argue that there's actually a groundswell of reform in health care going on around the country, state by state, whether it's Massachusetts or Illinois or Florida or California. People have figured out on a local level that this is an important issue, and there are ways to achieve government-supported health care, particularly for lower-income people, middle-income people as well. And I think perhaps that a candidate for 2008 who had a coherent health care program could go a long way with it.
Lots of state-level work on that front, no kidding. People pushing all over. The president in New Orleans yesterday said while he was there that it's his mission to shake loose federal aid that's been tied up in red tape.
There is money in the pipeline that I hope will help improve lives. And if it is stuck because of, you know, unnecessary bureaucracies, our responsibility at the federal, state, and local level is to unstick it.
Garrett's Frankie Ruta, the president, sort of saying, we've put the money up. It's stuck somewhere else down the line. We'll help unstick it, but it's kind of, we've done our job here.
Well, it's a little late for him to be realizing that. It would seem that, you know, when the hurricane hit was the time to make sure that this process went smoothly going forward. And what's happening in New Orleans has been a real tragedy. I mean, the city has been gutted. People are leaving the city. The city is going to wind up being much smaller and much poorer and with even higher crime than it was before the hurricane. And it's a real tragedy what's happening down there.
Let's take a call from Potsdam, New York, if I may, looking at this issue of government confidence in the government. John, you're on the air.
Yes. Yes, I think the problem with all these issues you've been talking about this morning, and I'm really glad that you bring all these things up, I think it's finally pretty obvious that there's this tremendous lack of competence on the part of the administration, and they can no longer hide it. They can no longer create a smokescreen where people just kind of, you know, okay, that's just the way it is. It's finally gotten so bad that everybody can see it now. And that's my comment on the issue.
John, we've got it, and we thank you for it. Jack, it may be a moment to turn to you on Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., historian who's looked out across the American landscape over many generations, kind of a FDR liberal, dyed-in-the-wool, has told the American story six ways to Sunday. From that perspective, there's a big voice gone this week, but a view that lingers on.
A view that lingers on, and with the death earlier last year of John Kenneth Galbraith, two giants, two lions of liberalism gone. Professor Schlesinger is very important to me personally. I knew him some. He did some writing for me at the Atlantic, and I associated with him a little. And it was just a pleasure to talk to him. He was a great historian. He wrote history in the grand manner. Ideas and action, policy and politics, men and event, all fused. His three volumes on the New Deal, the crisis of the old order, the coming of of the New Deal and the politics of upheaval are 1,500 pages of some of the greatest historical writing of the 20th century. That's just not me. That's a consensus. And rather than me go on, let me just give you the concluding paragraph of The Coming of the New Deal. Mm. The essence of Roosevelt, the quality which fulfilled the best in him and explained the potency of his appeal, was his intrepid and passionate affirmation. He always cast his vote for life, for action, for forward motion, for the future. His response to the magnificent emptiness of the Grand Canyon was typical. It looks dead. I like Hyde Park better. He responded to what was vital, not to what was lifeless, to what was coming, not to what was passing away. He lived by his exaltation in distant horizons and uncharted seas. It was this which won him confidence and loyalty in a frightened age, when the air was filled with the sound of certitudes cracking on every side. This, and the conviction of plain people that he had given them their head and heart and would not cease fighting in their cause. Arthur Schlesinger wrote that in The Coming of the New Deal, and an example of the prose that made his books a contribution to literature as well as history.
Dead at 89 on Wednesday this week. Garrett, I want to hear you on this, but first let's hear his voice. 1998, on the 30th anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination, Schlesinger's here saying that RFK would have beaten Richard Nixon if he had not been killed.
Well, I think that he would have won. He would have swiftly ended American involvement in the war in Vietnam, I think, which means that many Americans and many more Vietnamese and Cambodians would have returned safely to their homes.
Garance, there you are at the American Prospect, kind of torchbearer on that liberal front. Do you see the Schlesinger view resurgent, carrying on, still in abeyance? How do you look at it?
Well, the last few decades have not been a great age for American liberalism, but I do think that there's a real resurgence of liberal sentiment and liberal idealism, and I think a lot of people are actually looking to Barack Obama right now as a sort of new Kennedy-esque figure, and he's drawing tremendous crowds, 20,000 people in Austin, you know, it just people are so hungry for a kind of inspirational leadership and coming together as one nation after the divisive Bush years. And I think, you know, the pendulum has swung, and it'll be very interesting to see where things go from here.
Mark Silva, do you feel a pendulum swinging? Is it fair to say a big vote in November in Congress and, of course, the presidential campaign all ahead of us here now? But do you feel a pendulum swing in the air?
Well, there just may be. The Republicans are preparing to nominate a liberal, if you look at the polls. All this Republican momentum toward Rudy Giuliani is all motivated around the idea that he may be a winner, that he's electable. Garance and I traveled with Howard Dean on the Sleepless Summer Tour before the last campaign and saw crowds turn out looking for change, looking for a new direction. These were your core liberals, but you know, if the Republican Party itself is willing to turn towards someone who has acknowledged liberal tendencies, maybe something is changing. The American public ultimately always ends up in the middle. But if in fact a candidate who is somewhere toward the middle, toward the moderate wing of his party, can gain the nomination, that's interesting. On the Democratic side, that'll be a question too. How far they're willing to go, the Democrats this year.
Arthur Schlesinger, developing a theory of his father, saw a rhythm in American politics, almost like the beating of the heart, that every 30 years or so there are eras of renovation and of reform. And then after a period, the country goes back to personalism and business and away from governmental activism. And, you know, some people thought that the Clinton years were due for that resurgence of liberalism, but others said that it was really Bok then, because after Clinton gave up on his health care plan, essentially it became an administration of small initiatives. Now, where the pendulum goes in terms of the generations, one doesn't know. But his point was that people remember the president who was in office when they were young, and they want to recreate that. Well, I think, you know, for many people, that would be Ronald Reagan.
Yes, indeed.
And we may well, in that sense, be due for a renaissance of Reagan-like conservatism. So we just don't know about these things. I don't think there is any rhythm in American politics like that. I don't think it's any such determinism, but it's an interesting schema.
Garance, what do you feel then in the sort of McCain, Giuliani, Romney, Dancy Republicans still kind of looking for their arch conservative? You've got Brown back out there. We'll talk to him soon, but Mark Silva says maybe the pendulum swinging even inside the Republican Party if Giuliani is the viable front runner with his more liberal social views.
I think so. I think the situation with Giuliani also, I mean, you have to consider that he touches people, at least conservatives, in the same place that George Bush did after 9/11. It's this very emotional connection. And he has the benefit of being able to come across as being strong on terrorism without being tarnished by the Iraq War. So he has that advantage there. And McCain and Romney are going to be interesting. I mean, as far as I understand it, McCain and Romney are actually being looked at by the more liberal Republicans, and Giuliani is drawing support from conservatives. It doesn't make any sense on the face of it, and I'm still trying to understand this, but this is what I'm hearing.
It is going to be a fascinating year and a half and more going into this deep into this campaign. Let's get a call from Canton, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was commenting on a lack of responsibility, that some of the issues, particularly in Iraq, is that, you know, we're responsible for that mess. You know, yes, they had a dictator. There's a lot of dictators out there. We don't go out and take them all out. We don't disband all their armies and say, oh, my God, what a mess we have here. You guys should take care of this.
So if we're responsible, what does that mean? We do. The United States should do.
Well, I think that we have to do. We have to perhaps look at our strategy, but we have to do. We're responsible for it. As very honestly, as you know, listening, we're responsible, you know, for the health care crisis. And it's, I think this whole thing is about responsibility, that government hasn't taken responsibility, that maybe the shift to Giuliani is he was responsible. You know, he said, let me do what I can do as a mayor and step forward. And that's what's really lacking, is people, you know, not saying they're responsible, but actually being responsible.
So that may be the pendulum swing right there to responsibility, capital R. Steve, thanks for calling. Walter in Worcester, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. I just want to point out that you have a reporter on there who is a prime example of how the media has skewed reporting of liberals versus conservatives. Two quick points. Number one, he said the Democrats had squandered their mandate after coming in because they haven't been able to do anything about the war. Now, there is no parallelism between the Democrats squandering or being unable to find a way to stop Bush right now and the incredible damage that Bush has done to the country and the world, which is going to last forever. There's no parallelism at all, and you shouldn't be attacking the Democrats while acknowledging a situation in Afghanistan that's terrible and never once actually saying, well, these guys screwed it up. He didn't do that on your program.
You're saying a big difference in scale by your lights. Mark Silva, what do you say to that?
Well, I would say in short that I've already talked about the fiasco that the Bush administration created in Iraq with its absence of a policy about what to do after the invasion. And I would say that the Democrats now are in a position of having some power to do something about it, and they're not getting anywhere with it. So perhaps a failure on both sides.
I hear somebody wanting in there.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say the power they have, it seems to me, is very questionable indeed. I mean, they would have passed the resolution in the Senate, but for a Republican filibuster, that'll happen again. And if that were just even over the symbolic issue of the troop surge, imagine if the resolution was talking about cutting funding. The Republicans simply wouldn't let it pass. So effectively, I don't think there's anything the Democrats can do on the funding front. It isn't a matter of will. It's a matter of the opposition won't let them.
Garen's last word goes to you.
Well, if it were just up to the House, I think we would see considerable change. But there's also the matter of the Senate, and the Senate is going to act as a very effective block over the next 2 years. So, unfortunately, the Democrats are going to be in a little bit of a holding pattern. But what they can do, and what will be the watchword for the next few years, is accountability. And there will be hearings, and there will be a certain amount of truth-telling and holding the administration accountable. And I think that's the most significant thing that Democrats are going to be able to accomplish.
Mark Silva, just a couple of seconds. Put us back on that plane with Dick Cheney over the Middle East. Any sign of him backing down here?
No, sir. He is the last bulwark of the Bush administration. The policy stands firm and immutable with Dick Cheney.
The unidentified administration spokesman, Mark Silva, White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Great to have you with us this hour, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Garen's Frankie Ruta at the American Prospect. Garen, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Jack Beatty, always good to have you. Have a good weekend. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.